First, I apologize for being late. I was actually in a meeting managing your money, and we had some big decisions to make, and so I had I was working a bit later than I expected. The presentation I'm going to give you is an abbreviated presentation that I've recently delivered to what we call our stewards and stakeholders. The Canada Pension Plan, as some of you may know, is a creature of the federal and provincial governments, and our trustee body, in effect, is indeed your elected representatives through the federal and provincial systems. And so I just finished a tour of the western provinces and eastern provinces and Ottawa, talking to ministers of finance and their senior deputies, and I've lifted from that presentation this material. And what it is from a risk management perspective, think of it, this is risk management of a national pension plan. And it's a unique organization because national pension plans really don't have a closing date. As long as the nation continues, it goes on and on and on. So the idea of matching your books at the end of each night because you have capital requirements, well, that's not really there, but nonetheless, there's a risk that you have to manage, and I'll give you that particular perspective. And it's the risk that we're actually, the risk concerns, risk guidelines were given to us by our stewards, but in very general terms. If I do have time, and there is a little, the last part of the presentation deals with applying risk management a bit more rigorously to a national pension plan to try and distinguish between the economic value of the promise that's provided through Canada Pension Plan benefits and the expected cost of providing those benefits. And it's actually how expensive it is to lay off risks of a national pension plan if we get there, because there's an underlying and emerging debate about whether retirement income in Canada should be financed more in the future from public sector arrangements such as the Canada Pension Plan, or continued provision through private sector arrangements such as DB plans. But if you're familiar with the issues, DB plans, certainly in the private sector, are becoming fewer in number because they're relatively risky and expensive to actually run. So with that background, is there a secret? Oh, there it is. I'll give you some background exactly how the Canada Pension Plan is run, some key points that you really need to appreciate in a general sense in order to understand exactly some of the risk-return accountability framework that we've developed. I'll talk about our investment mission, because that goes to the heart of exactly why the fund was set up, how we manage the money, how we seek return, how we understand risks, and how we report to our stakeholders and to our stewards, and indirectly, really, to yourselves. I'm assuming that the vast majority of you do make contributions to the Canada Pension Plan. Then I'll get into sort of the guts of the framework, exactly how we have risk return and accountability, because the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, who we report to, they demanded accountability that if you guys are going to manage the money, if you guys are going to enter into all these complicated strategies, and if we're going to pay you high salaries, we want to see a pure demonstration of value. And I'll show you exactly how we extract that. And then from a public policy perspective, how stakeholders or future stakeholders, when they're looking back at the public policy experiment of the Canada Pension Plan and the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, was it a successful public policy? And I'll show you the actual criteria that is being suggested to be used by the federal provincial ministers when they get together and evaluate this program. And then finally, if I haven't run up some time, we'll talk about the economic value of benefits. I have an ongoing interest in this, but for the sake of time, I might actually just end it at this particular point. First is, if you can, this is a diagrammatic representation of the contribution rates of the Canada Pension Plan, so let me just take you through the diagram. Here we have the calendar years. The plan was actually set up in 1966, okay? And then you go on here. Here's where we are now, roughly about 2006, then it quickly goes up to 2050. That time scale is severely expressed or compressed, and you can map out what I've done here is mapped out the what we call the pay-as-you-go contribution rate, the contribution rates that are necessary to collect, to actually pay benefits out that current year. That's what we call a pay-go rate. So you pay benefits, you set the contribution rate at such the level you have to pay the benefits that year. We call that the pay-go rate. And we express the pay-go rate as a percentage of the year's maximum pensionable earnings, or the YMPE, so that's your contributory base. I think that's about $47,000 now or something. So when you make your income tax each year, there's a 9.9 divided by 2 contribution rate. You make that contribution, well, that's what the YMPE is. And the solid line is actually the legislated contribution rate. That's the contribution rate that is actually put in by law, and it's collected by Revenue Canada. And initially it was set at 3.6, stayed at 3.6 until 1997. Then there's a schedule put in place in recognition that the actual pay-as-you-go rate was much higher than the actual contribution rate, and the difference was the accumulated funds were being drawn down. Okay? And then, indeed, we saw that the demographic problem was getting even worse than expected. So indeed, there was a much more rapid rise in the contribution rate to 9.9. A large fund was accumulated. That fund is being invested in the capital markets, and that's what the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board is actually managing money. So the difference between the solid line and that dotted line, that actually represents the accumulation of the assets, and we're responsible for managing those assets. Now, I've highlighted this particular box here, and it references 9.8, and that's what we call the sustainable rate. What the actuary actually does is, the legislated rate is 9.8, the legislated rate is 9.9. What the actuary actually does, the actuary of the plan who resides in Ottawa and is independent of the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, he recognizes that there's basically two sources of income to actually pay benefits. One source is actually the contribution that people pay on a year-by-year basis. The other source of income is the investment earnings on the accumulated capital. Okay? So he can actually take those two variables, add in economic growth, mortality tables, and the expected earnings on different asset classes, and makes an estimate of what they call the sustainable rate is, given all these particular factors, what contribution rate can be established today under a given set of assumptions that in principle would never have to be changed again, and the plan could continue in perpetuity or until the end of the forecast period, and you continue to pay the benefits promised without raising the contribution rate. That's the sustainable contribution rate, and that's 9.8. The sustainable contribution rate was purposely set below the 9.9 legislative rate. Okay? Now the 9.98, that's a very dynamic number. Okay? That changes on a day-by-day basis. As soon as the size of the fund changes because capital falls in the capital market, the fund declines by 20%, then the investment earnings might grow as much in the past, but on a lower base. Therefore, the sustainable rate might pop up. Demographic aging could actually affect the plan, and indeed the sustainable rate could change because the assumptions change. So there's a definition of the sustainable rate. As of December 31, 2003, the sustainable rate was 9.8, 10 basis points below the legislative rate. So the legislative rate, the sustainable rate is here. And you can see exactly at different points of time how the sustainable rate actually moves around. In 1997, when the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board was established, the sustainable rate was 9.9. Then it dropped down to 9.7, then it jumped up to 9.8, 9.84. So that's a product of the changing size of the fund. That's a product of changing assumptions in mortality. That's a product of changing assumptions of inflation. That's a product of the changing assumptions of investment earnings. So there's a whole bunch of factors that are moving into that. The one particular criteria that the policymakers made very clear when they established the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, he says, the one risk that we want you to contribute to managing, the one risk that we would like you to help us manage is keeping the sustainable rate, to the extent possible, below the 9.9 rate. We don't want to go back to the Canadian population and say that for a given set of benefits, we're now going to have to raise the legislative rate even higher than the 9.9. Okay? So they sent us a very strong signal, an unequivocal signal, that's the risk that they actually want us to manage. So all our decisions, really, going forward from that basis is, what investment strategies maximize the probability that the investment performance from the money that we manage will make a positive contribution to lowering the future sustainable rate to lower than it would be if indeed the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board was not there. We'll come back to that criteria in a second, but that's the principal dominant risk factor that we're managing within the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board. There's some interesting stuff here, but let me just say that in order for the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board to be successful, we really have to get kind of four things right. We have to have a good governance vision, a good investment vision, and an organizational vision. I'm talking about the investment vision, and need a good CEO to pull all that stuff together. We've now got the investment vision, exactly the best way we think national pension plan money should be run, and we're now doing the organizational structure. It took us 6 or 7 months to actually reach this investment vision. It's going to take us 5 years to actually get the right organizational structure to deliver on that. The success is not having a good investment idea. They're almost a dime a dozen. The success is having a good execution process to actually capture the investment idea. That's difficult. And what's the principal problem here? You got to deal with people. Managing assets are pretty straightforward. Managing people is a pain in the ass, I tell you. That's really demanding. But just a little aside. So our investment mission is twofold. When the stewards got together, they effectively said, with respect to the 9.9 contribution rate, they said, your job is to help lower future contribution rates by diversifying into higher returning asset classes. Previous to our existence, the Canada Pension Plan was invested in nothing but non-marketable government bonds. Okay? And the stewards made it very clear they did not want that underlying sustainable rate to exceed the 9.9 legislative rate. They're just paranoid about that. They gave us some guidelines. And the one thing they pointed out very clearly is they recognized to us investment earnings, investment success of the Canada Pension Plan is only one factor that actually contributes to lowering the sustainable rate. There are other factors that have more immediate and have more leverage on the sustainable rate. A faster aging population that is currently contemplated by the actuary, that has more impact on the future sustainable rate than in investment earnings. Why is that? Because the investment earnings really, even in maturity, make up maybe 30% of the amount of income needed in any 1 year to pay the benefits. In most fully mature private sector pension plans that are fully funded, not partially funded, it's closer to 50 or 60%. So the board, the steward said, basically use capital market returns. Go out and just harvest capital market returns. And we believe, based upon past experience, that the capital market returns invested in basically a portfolio of 60% stocks and 40% bonds, the typical asset mix policy that most public plans run in Canada, that would generate enough real return to actually help lower the contribution rate to levels below the 9.9 legislated rate. Then in the year 2000, based upon the Nortel experience, where Nortel became, I think it became 30-40% of the TSE, that was clearly a bubble situation. When the board was first set up, all the assets were required to be invested in index funds. In index funds, they are very low-cost, inexpensive ways to actually harvest the return to what we call beta risk or capital market risk. This becomes an important concept because this actually becomes a yardstick to measure the value of the management decisions of the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board. But in the year 2000, there was a board-approved management initiative that the board and management went back to the stakeholders and said, we want you to relax the terms of reference and allow us to actively manage the assets. Because we see investment strategies that have a high probability of increasing returns over basically passive portfolios. Okay. The index strategy was Stewart designed and written into the legislation. Management, in effect, imposed another mission by actually going back to the stewards and asking for our mandate to be changed. Okay. To give you an idea of the potential impact of improved returns on the sustainable rate, for every 50 basis points increase in return that the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board can earn by earning incremental returns through active management or better beta diversified portfolio returns, we can lower the long-term sustainable rate by 25 basis points. Okay, so that's the trade-off. So from our particular perspective, that if we can add, let's say, 100 basis points, 1 percentage points, in perpetuity or on average for multiple generations, we can actually reduce the contribution rates that Canadians would have to pay by a full 50 basis points. That's the actual mechanical trade-off. Okay? That's the reward for making good active management decisions. That's the reward for making good beta decisions. Now, the board recognizes this particular trade-off. They says, okay, if you're going to do that, that's fine. But the board required management to design, adopt, and implement a risk-return accountability framework that measured that success. They said it has to be crystal clear to us that indeed you're adding value, and how much value, and over what time periods. And it has to be crystal clear to the stewards, when we go to stewards, to justify why there's 400 people working at the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, when the strategy of just investing in index funds would just require basically 3 people. And indeed, if you have all these active management and these investment manager people, they're not working for free. Their salaries are big ticket items, and they're getting incentive payments. So they have to cover their costs as well. So any particular program you have in place has to be in alignment. We don't want you paying these people big salaries unless they're bringing big value to the fund. And in order to actually ascertain if they're bringing big value to the fund, we need a crystal clear mechanism for evaluating how much value is actually brought to the table. So that was the particular framework. Any questions about that? I'm going to take a little break here. Okay, how do we actually tackle the risk return accountability framework? Well, the first thing is we decided to effectively define or introduce what we call the CPP reference portfolio. This will actually be a highlighted item in our annual report, which will be published in the next few weeks. And the advent of this, the development of this risk-return accountability framework will be profiled there. The first thing is this CBP reference portfolio is in effect our benchmark. What it's made up is the following, is that it contains 65% equity exposure, broken up between two broad markets, the Canadian equity markets and the foreign equity markets, in these weightings, 25% and 40%. This is not the product of some sophisticated optimization model. If you do any kind of optimization model, you can always find out weights like this. The reason why we selected 65% equity exposure is for two reasons. One is we went back to the actual risk guidelines that the original stewards expressed with us in what we call the Federal-Provincial Agreement. They told us, in effect, geez, based upon our actuarial projections, if the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board ran an asset mix policy that was roughly similar to all the largest, biggest public sector plans in Canada, and if past capital market performance was reasonably representative of future capital market performance, you'd probably earn a 4.2% real rate of return that is just enough, with the other assumptions being fulfilled, would keep the sustainable rate below 9.9. So if you look at the actual equity exposure of large public sector pension plans in Canada, they look pretty close to 65% equity. What we have is a 40% exposure in foreign equities that is probably much higher than the foreign exposure of equities in most Canadian pension funds, but there's a liability mitigating risk reason for that, and I'll explain that in a second. The balance of the portfolio, the reference portfolio, is invested in 35% debt, of which 25% is in nominal Canadian debt, and 10% is in real return bonds. Why those particular exposures? Well, Canadian nominal bonds, for historical reasons, those non-marketable debentures that the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board inherited, because that was the investment vehicle for the fund initially, we have to hold those funds until they actually roll out. And the option, and the provincial governments have one more option to roll that debt. So probably for the next 10 or 15 years, we're going to have at least 25% pretty close to 20, will be dominated by these already fixed exposures to these non-marketable debt. So we really couldn't go much lower than 25% initially, because we'll be forced to hold at least that much nominal debt, because that's what the provincial bonds represent in the portfolio. The 10% part, sorry, I thought I heard a question, sorry. The 10% real return bonds, the Canada Pension Plan benefits are fully escalated to inflation. Real return bonds provide contractual assurance that you're going to get back your real return, so it provides a natural hedge to real return liability. So that's the attractive feature of real return bonds, and that's why the balance goes there. It's a very, very small hedge. You wouldn't want a much larger hedge, because they only earn about, you buy them today, you only get about 1.7% real, and the actuary has already indicated you need on average about 4.2% real over the life of the projection in order to actually keep the sustainable rate below 9.9. So every time you increase your exposure to real return bonds that only earn 1.7, the other assets have to work an awful lot harder, okay? It's a good match, but it's a bad investment. People always ask, so this is the starting point for all of our portfolio decisions. I won't go in today and explain exactly how we make individual asset class weightings and portfolio decisions, but this is basically all of our starting point. Effectively, we can invest all of the CPPIB assets in index funds that replicate these particular asset classes, and we can deliver on that first mission. Capture the capital market returns very cheaply and in a low-cost mechanism by going out to somebody like Barclays Global Investors, some of the world's largest index fund manager. Why do we have 40% foreign equity, and why is it unhedged? Well, 40% equity provides two benefits. First, it's an equity return, so it has the high long-term expected rate of return we're looking for. And it diversifies total portfolio volatility, especially the equity risk that we have in the Canadian market. The Canadian market globally is only about 3% of all equities, and so we like to hedge that risk. But more importantly, it mitigates the risk of lower than expected wage growth, which would increase the sustainable contribution rate. You go back and recognize, geez, you know, the Canada Pension Plan contribution rate, at the end of the day, though there are investment earnings, the fund that the maximum will only be about 25% funded. So really, the actual performance of the future contribution rate is being dominated by the underlying pay-as-you-go rate. And in effect, if the future growth of payroll in Canada is less than is projected by the actuary, that will mean that sustainable rate will have to increase. So what the CPPIB board is looking for is for a source of returns that, if the growth of Canadian salaries is disappointing relative to what the actuary is expecting, can we have a compensating source of income to make up the difference or mitigate that risk? The only place we can really do that is outside of Canada, because the salaries are being, if salary growth is disappointing relative to expectation, there's a pretty high probability that capital market returns are going to be disappointing. Okay? And countries cannot self-insure. They have to look for other countries to provide the insurance. So that's why you have foreign equities. So what you're hoping for, if Canada has a disappointing economic experience, and it's prolonged, and it's reflected in lower than expected salary growth, requiring a sustainable contribution rate to go up, you're hoping that your foreign exposure will help make up that difference. And you're hoping that the actual systematic disappointing experience in Canada is not being shared or mirrored in other economies. If it isn't being shared in other economies, that it's a global problem, well, then the risk isn't going to work. Well, there's no such thing as a perfect hedge, and this is a clear demonstration of that. And the currency exposure, by leaving the foreign exposure unhedged in its normal position, or its strategic position, it effectively magnifies that hedge. Because if the Canadian economy is doing poorly, and wages are doing poorly, there's a good chance that the Canadian dollar is doing poorly relative to other currencies. It's almost the reverse situation as of today. You see the Canadian economy doing well, the money's flowing in to invest in commodities, really salaries are growing at a faster rate than are being contemplated by the actuary, the sustainable rate in principle is going down. Well, okay, well, that's good news. And it's being somewhat offset, I guess, by the foreign exposure, but you don't need that at that particular time. Okay. So what the foreign currency does, it actually magnifies the properties of foreign equity. So when we think about this reference portfolio, here are the criteria, the valuable criteria of using this as a starting point to evaluate our risk-return decisions. First, it embodies the risk-return requirements that the stakeholders, the people we report to, the people who represent you, that's the type of risk we want you to take. We want you to take 100% equity. We don't want you to go 30% equity, because we can't get there from here. It partially matches the CPP net liabilities. That's why we had that large foreign exposure. Okay, liabilities are domestic. They're national. They cannot be insured within Canada. You have to seek insurance elsewhere. It's a low cost, low complexity, but a genuine, viable strategy. All the money could be actually invested in that. And to give you an idea, we went out and we worked with BGI, and for our $100 billion portfolio we have today, they said, here are the terms by which they would assume responsibility for managing all of that money. They would say, we would manage all that money for you, against the indexes that you specified, and we would provide you with basically 95% assurance that over moving six-year periods, you would get the return of that underlying reference portfolio, less 3 basis points because of transactions cost and friction and everything else. Plus, we'd need a tracking error of about 11 basis points. We would provide that all for you for a price of how many basis points? For zero. They would do it for free. And why would they do it for free? They said because you wouldn't have to write us a check. All we would want is to have 1/3 of the security lending money for all those securities. Okay. So from a steward's perspective, you wouldn't need the office down at One Queen or all the offices we're going to build globally, but you could literally run this national program for free with that particular tracking error. So this becomes a natural comparison point to evaluate exactly the value, the incremental value that is brought to the table by CPP Investment Management Board. And I mentioned that you'd only need 3 people at the CPPIB to actually manage the BGI relationship. Why 3 people? Well, you need the CEO so you can actually report up to the board. You need the secretary to take phone calls and make appointments. And you need the actual investment professional who actually meets with BGI once a week over lunch to see how the portfolio is going. Those are all the people you need. And indeed, that the one investment manager wouldn't even be allowed to accept hockey tickets because our conflict of interest actually prevents us from actually any of our suppliers taking us out to public events. The only event we can take is private golf lessons. So it becomes an easy way to evaluate management decision making and easy to understand by stakeholders, which are also another criteria that if anybody who's sort of planning for retirement or near retirement or reading the financial press, index fund management as an alternative to active management is a pretty common currency. You see it advertised and recommended. Eric Kirchner of the University of Toronto, at least once every couple of weeks, he advocates in personal financial columns, you don't give your money to active managers, you just invest in exchange-traded trusts and rebalance, and you're guaranteed to actually beat 75% of all active managers and probably 90% of all active managers after fees. And so it's a very viable strategy, and it's a strategy that a lot of Canadians currently elect. So it's a pretty easy reference point. Pause the stretch. Yeah. And it was an interesting concept. And actually, when we pushed BGI for this, not so much Bill Chinnery, because he's the local person, but we actually went down to the San Francisco office. They said, well, look, John, I've worked with you for a long time. As you know, quite honestly, we think with almost 100% certainty that we can deliver you benchmark level returns without the 3 basis point shortage, but we need that tracking error, and we can provide it just for 1/3 of the security lending costs. And I said, would you write that down in a contract form and put your company's capital at risk to guarantee any shortfall? He says, whoa, you couldn't do that. You know, but indeed, that's how confident they were. So it is. The point is, it's a viable strategy. Okay. So question is, well, if that's the starting point, how does the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board expect to earn returns above that? And we show it in this particular format. First, we know how the actual liabilities of the Canada Pension Plan behave. We know what the CPP reference portfolio is. We call that the necessary asset and liability mismatch. That's a mismatch that all plans have to run in order to actually have some kind of reasonable cost over the long term. And essentially, we pursue three strategies. These are three sources of value added. we build a better beta portfolio. We actually invest in other streams of income that have a low correlation but comparable returns to the portfolio we've already built. So that would be like private real estate, that would be timber, that would be aquifers, the standard host of investment strategies that aren't easily captured in index fund management. Secondly, a captive active sources of alpha. There are investment managers, we believe, that can, over reasonable periods of time, add value above benchmarks. We have basically a hedge fund strategy overlying the Canada Pension Plan, a long and short strategy where we have four very sophisticated global equity managers who have basically the LIBOR benchmark, and they can go long and short different securities, and they earn a return above that. They short the actual securities in our portfolio because we've got a big portfolio. We never net short any particular security just because we're so large, but they add value on top of that, and we can find other strategies like that. And another one, we can take advantage of our unique position. What does that mean? Well, a lot of people want to approach funds of our size who have a tremendous amount of liquidity, long time horizons, no immediate need for capital draws. We can invest in long-term illiquid infrastructure strategies. Classic example, you could go to Chile and you can invest in their power line system. And in order to actually receive this large bulk of capital, the people who need that capital are prepared to actually sell that future stream of potential income at a relatively low cost because there's no other sources of large, bulky pieces of capital like that. And you can earn returns that are 500, 600, 700, 1,000 basis points above comparable equity returns. You have to give up some illiquidity. There are some associated risks in that, but indeed you are a supplier of capital, okay? And also general partners of large buyout funds, such as KKR, the buyout strategies they have increasingly require larger and larger amounts of capital. There are fewer and fewer sources of larger amounts of capital available. The Canada Pension Plan is one of those sources of capital. So if you have something that other people want, capital, source of liquidity, you can provide the money almost overnight if necessary, people are prepared to actually pay for that and prepared by actually giving you a larger portion of future return streams. So those are the three sources of investment strategies, and I could go into that in detail, but let's wrap it up in a format that most of you might be familiar with. This is a variation of the classic Markowitz efficient frontier. And what we have on the vertical axis is the expected real return. And I've marked off here, this is the 4.2% real that under the current actuarial valuation of the Canada Pension Plan, that essentially the actuary says, if all of my other assumptions work out, all the Canada Pension Plan has to do is earn 4.2% real on average over the forecast horizon, and that will result in a sustainable rate of 9.8. Okay? If we earn more than 4.2, let's say 4.3 or something, then the sustainable rate actually goes down. You see it's 9.8, 9.9, 10, but it's reverse. Better returns mean lower sustainable rate. If we earn returns below 4.2, the sustainable rate starts to rise and bumps against the 9.9. So all I've done, and along the vertical axis is indeed the volatility or the expected risk. And here's the actual trade-offs. As you go up there, it's 100% equity portfolio. As you go down here, it becomes basically the real return bond portfolio. You can see here, our low risk or matching asset is indeed real return bonds leveraged out to about 40 years, but you can see the expected rate of return at 1.77, you already lost the game. You can't possibly win. So really, any asset allocation strategy or any asset liability mismatch below this level is just non-starter. It's an academic exercise. It's just not a possible area of decision. And so that's essentially the trade-off. What we've added is just on this particular side is the sustainable rate. And the sustainable rate, that's the center point. You can kind of think of the sustainable rate as having kind of a normal distribution. Not necessarily a normal distribution. We don't know about that yet. We're finding that out. But there is a distribution around that. And we're busily working on that and trying to get in the covariance impact of all the various factors that affect national pension plans, just so we have a better idea of our risk exposure. So with that framework, we just put on the reference portfolio. And the reference portfolio, basically, this is mission one. Mission one is achieved, and we could go right there, the reference portfolio. Some people would call the reference portfolio a naive beta strategy. You're just naively collecting beta. Other people, a bit more critical, call that the no-brainer portfolio. And but we'll start there. Then what we do is we build a better beta portfolio. So the expectation is not only will we reduce risk by diversifying, but indeed we'll actually pick up incremental returns. And then so we have a higher returns and lower risk, which is an attractive feature. Then we add alpha strategies on top of that. And it goes up in a straight line. And why is that? Is because most alpha strategies or value-adding strategies through security selection, they have a zero correlation with the markets. So really, it doesn't add risk. That doesn't increase the actual variation of returns. It just shifts the return distribution left to the right. If you're successful, it goes to the right. If you're unsuccessful, it goes to the left. But the width of the distribution stays pretty much the same. So that's why it goes up there. That's why alpha is always such an attractive item. But it's very hard to find, hard to maintain, and it's usually expensive when you do find it. And then suddenly you get your measurement criteria, is that the easiest thing to always measure is the improved returns relative to the CP reference portfolio. So we track the reference portfolio every day. We know exactly how that's behaving. That's we will be, yes. Yeah. Yeah, what we're actually, like I mentioned, what you see here, the framework and the criteria had just been recently approved by the board, December 21st, I think to be exact, of the last year, and we're implementing it. We have to go back to the board. What the board has given is, the board has approved the reference portfolio. We've got a total fund target value added for the next 5 years, about 67 basis points average. Now we have to go back and actually seek a risk budget at the total portfolio level. So relative to the reference portfolio, we'll be seeking latitude from the board, plus or minus on the volatility of the reference portfolio. We can actually make alpha and beta decisions within that. So we spend that risk any way we see. No. Well, we have, but all we know is the beta chews up risk pretty fast, okay, because you start, and alpha has the attractive feature that because it is orthogonal to the portfolio, that's the better way to spend risk. The disappointing thing about alpha is it tends to be undependable for long periods of time. So that's the particular criteria. So we're in the midst of actually evaluating different risk budget ranges around that. Does that answer your question? When I took this out to my colleagues in the different jurisdictions, many of them are also governing trustees of public sector plans. They were, the idea that you would actually use a risk budgeting framework to delegate to management not only alpha decisions, but beta decisions, that you don't have to come back and get approval for investing in timber, approval for investing in private real estate, approval for investing in aquifers, they were just floored that indeed you could, that a board would consider giving management that accountability. But from our board's perspective, they said, the question is, it doesn't matter, we'll give you latitude that you can lose so much money. It's the money we're concerned about. We don't care how you, you know, whether you lose $100 million on a beta strategy or an alpha strategy or an aquifers, the fact is you've lost the money. So the one attractive thing about risk budgeting is it's a universal numeraire. You don't have to worry about the investment strategies. You just have to worry about the potential risk associated with the investment strategies. That's the constraint the board is putting on us. And then there's the risk reduction relative to the reference portfolio. Just on that particular point, the board is really focusing primarily on the incremental returns, because the risk reduction to the reference portfolio, once you get into a private real estate or private equity or infrastructure, you're almost guaranteed to reduce the measured risk, because so many of these strategies are actually appraisal priced. And because when you report this in publications, it's always the appraised value, you really don't see the underlying volatility. So the actual criteria will be established, will be attributing or imputing volatility to a non-market traded securities. So the board doesn't want to, our compensation system is being transparent with respect to the public, with respect to something that is easily measured, and it's not the sort of artificial risk reduction. And then the question is, well, how did the risk the reference portfolio actually work relative to other investment choices? Effectively, the board was worried when they saw the reference portfolio. They said, geez, did you define a slow rabbit? Did you have you got the hurdle low enough that it's easier to jump over? And then so we went back, and of course we didn't do it at motivations at all, but we went back and re-ran history as if the reference portfolio was in place, and we ran it from 1992 to 2004. And the reason why we selected that period is 1992 was the first year that real-term bond indexes were available, so you could actually run the reference portfolio. And so there's actually the performance of the reference portfolio. There's the performance of the median Canadian pension fund over that period. And if you put in other pension funds, the reference portfolio would have outperformed probably 95% of all pension funds in Canada. A natural reference point would be the Ontario Teachers, roughly the same size. Their performance would have been just about here. A significant reduction in measured risk. Their value added above our reference portfolio, and our reference portfolio had the same level of systematic risk that was embedded in the Ontario Teachers Plan over this period. They added about 90 basis points, of which that was before cost. Once you take out cost, they basically had about 22 or 23 basis points of implementation costs. That's overhead costs, fees, salaries, bonuses. What was left in the fund was 70 basis points. So that gives you the rough order of magnitude. And if the teachers are appropriately considered one of the gold standards of investment management, that was an indication that the reference portfolio is not a slow rabbit. It's a very demanding rabbit. And if anybody is familiar with the area, it's pretty hard over the long term to beat the index markets. You can see what RRBs did, a full portfolio of RRBs, and there's a 100% equity portfolio. So that particular framework, that green shade is our playground. That's where the board expects us to be as we go forward. Here's our target. To outperform the reference portfolio, we expect to be in here. We do have the latitude to, within our risk budget, raise our strategic risk or time our strategic risk. We do have the flexibility to change equity exposure at the funds, currency, et cetera, so we have all the actual latitudes you want. It's all relative. What exposures do we want relative to the reference portfolio? Do we think those exposures are going to get paid off? If we don't like those exposures, or if we think the potential reward is declined, we change those exposures. And everything, all our reporting reports are all relative to the reference portfolio. And what the reference portfolio is useful for, it actually captures the changing risk return reward that the capital markets gives investors, okay? We have no control over that. The board recognizes that. That's where we would like to be, to target that particular area. How did the reference, so these are actual numbers now. The first time we actually managed money was $26 million in equities we got in March 1999. And so we can actually go back and actually compare how the reference portfolio would have performed since our inception date relative to the 4.2% real rate of return. And there's the reference portfolio. Over this period of time, the reference portfolio would have underperformed the long-term 4.2% real rate of return. Well, that shouldn't come to a surprise with anybody, because equities have not been rewarded in general for the risk over the last this particular period. But you invest prospectively, you don't expect that to continue going in the future. The capital markets just aren't going to work. You can just see how poorly equities did perform over the period. You can see that during a period of declining inflation and declining interest, you really wanted to have an all bond portfolio. And you can see why in bond portfolios, as the interest rates go down, because inflation goes down, interest rates go down, those bond prices rise, and the closer they go down, the duration actually starts to rise and actually accelerates the program. What did the CPPIB portfolio actually perform like? Well, our actual return over that period was above, was 4.7, 4.5 real. Well, why was that? Well, over this period of time, we invested a portfolio that was basically nearly 100% bonds. We're transitioning to a diversified portfolio. We were rewarded by having exposure to the best performing asset class, long bonds, not by intent, but because in order to get from point A to point B, we basically had to sell down the bonds or wait for the bonds to rise down and use new cash flows to build up our equity exposures. So we outperformed the 4.2% real, not because our long-term strategy performed well, indeed it didn't perform well over the period, but because during our transition period, just our large bond exposure worked to our favor. I'll skip over that. I'll skip over this. Judging long-term success, this is the little grid that we'll be using. If you think about it, there's two experiments going on here. There's a public policy experiment initiated by the stewards who decided to increase the funding of the Canada Pension Plan, and they said, let's go to the capital markets, let's invest the money in index funds, and we'll use the capital markets to actually help pay future benefits. Okay, and we need a public policy vehicle for that. We'll set up the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, and they can do that for us. So basically, their public policy is, will the future capital market performance be strong enough to actually help lower future contribution rates? So really, that's a public policy, you know. A thoughtful policy, did it actually work out in fact? So the reference portfolio earns the returns that are expected by the stewards given their faith in the capital markets. If the answer is yes, then the policy experiment has been a success. If the answer is no, good idea, it just didn't work out. Okay. Then here's the other particular experiment that's going on. This is the experiment the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board imposed on itself to actively manage the assets. So if the CPPIB outperforms the reference portfolio, if the answer to that is yes, then indeed that mission was successful. Even if the public policy proves to be the right policy but a disappointing outcome, we can still be successful, okay? Because we're being judged relative to what the capital markets would actually give you to an index fund. No, well, public policy could be very successful, and it could earn 5 or 6% real. We could subtract 60 basis points. We'd be a real disappointment, but indeed the sustainable rate would still be below the 9.9 legislated rate. The worst case scenario is that, public policy, capital markets didn't pay what was expected going forward, and the Canada Pension Plan dug a deeper hole, and everybody enjoys a much higher contribution rate than they otherwise would have, and terrible life, but you know, that's it, you know, that's risk for you. And so why don't I just stop there and just see if there's any questions.